Hey guys, I'm Taboo.
And I'm Church.
And we are the Dark Souls 2.
And welcome to the Dark Souls 2.
This episode...
You really can't handle your alcohol. This episode will be about Hades Tower of Flame. Perhaps one of the most interesting of the early areas, I think.
Yeah, it's actually very lore-rich, and there's definitely some points that I want to cover that I don't think would come up in other areas of the game. But we have a couple of announcements first.
So... firstly, and this is probably the most exciting thing that's happened since the game came out, is there's footage for the PC version.
Holy shit.
And it looks really good. It looks awesome.
I think this is what we've both been waiting for, to be honest.
Absolutely. I mean, just for a bit of history, Jammer and I only bought the game because on console, that is, because we couldn't get it on PC. We're PC players, but we're playing it on a console, you know, kind of waiting, anticipating that the PC version will be released.
I think you're selling yourself a bit short there, though, Church. I've been a PC player through and through since basically PS1 era, but you've been a console player most of your life.
Yeah, I know, all right? And the reasoning for that is because, well, I was just stupid. I was hoping that by the end of that sentence I'd have a decent reason, you know, thought up, but I didn't, so I just had to kind of concede.
So, some things that have been released about the PC version, the things that we care and want to know about. 1080p is actually going to have 1080 pixel resolution textures.
Yeah, which, so it's going to look awesome.
I mean, the last game came out, it was a console port, you know, we all know the history there. It was sort of pushed out because the PC gamers wanted it. So they did what they could to get it out, and they didn't really put the time and effort into it. We're not going to go over that too much, but long and short was...
you can hear the bitterness in his voice.
Yeah, I loved it. Best game I've ever played, but it certainly needed work. And this time around, it seems like they've put in that work straight from the bat. So,
I might need you to cut this, and everyone will just think I'm just kidding anyway.
But I can see what's happening.
I got my finger stuck in my beer bottle, so just give me a sec. Hold on. Well, here's proof. Oh, it actually came out. Okay. Anyway, never mind. So, 1080p.
Right. So...
but it's going to look amazing. It really is going to look spectacular.
Yep. Resolution's there. It will run at 60 frames per second. Even on the lowest settings, it looks better than the console. So that's just, again, this isn't like all console players are shit or anything like that. It's just, these are the facts. It does look better on PC. It actually looks quite amazing on PC. Though I've got to say, the one thing that left me most disappointed is they put in all this effort to implement this whole torch dynamic for the game, which... you've got to walk around with a torch in the dark areas. You have to illuminate it. The lighting is beautiful and stuff. But they just didn't execute it right. The dark areas aren't dark enough. I, throughout the game, have collected about an hour and a half's worth of torches.
Yeah, me too.
And I've used maybe, what, 5-6 minutes?
Yeah. And it's like I've never, ever needed it.
Yeah.
Ever.
There's only one area that comes to my mind where I needed a torch, and I think you guys will all know it when you've been there. Other than that, it's not been essential. So they kind of were a wasted potential there, pointless. And so I was hoping that they were going to completely overhaul it on the PC version. Like, they've spent the extra time, these extra weeks doing it. Why wouldn't they? It's easier to implement lighting effects in a PC version of a game, but they haven't. Apparently the lighting's pretty much the same, which kind of disappointing.
Yeah, look, I agree. I mean, I kind of thought the torches were going to be an integral part of the game.
Mm.
Alas, no. So yeah, there you go. There's some confirmation that the PC version is going to be as awesome as we hoped it would be. The other thing, which I'm really, really excited about, is that the patch is coming out. Patch 1.03.
And before we go on to that, 25th of April. So what, 15 days? So that's not nuts. Not far. 2 weeks. Okay, yes. Sorry, patch.
Oh my God.
Talked about it last week. 1.03. We won't go over all the changes because we talked about them on the last app, but, well, I logged into the game 2 nights ago, and I was greeted with a information screen. First time it's actually happened since I bought the game. Yeah, the information screen is pretty much saying, hey guys, the patch, it is coming out, and here's the date. So we have some days for you.
But then it didn't say there is no new information, which I've become so used to that it's kind of comforting. But obviously... because you're playing on a PS3 and I'm playing on the Xbox.
Yeah.
Your dates are different to my dates.
I was going to ask. We never discussed this before the recording.
So mine says 11th of April, 6 p.m. GMT. That's it. Roll out all over the world. One time. One day.
Oh, wow. Okay. So if you're playing on Xbox, from Church's confirmation, 11th of April. That's the date you're looking for 1.03. For the PS3, it seems they're doing a more rolling release. So 9th of April for Asia, 11th of April for Oceania, and 11th of April for America.
And what's EMEA?
I haven't a damn clue. So that's directly from the screenshot I took of the release, 11th of April, 9 a.m. GMT, EMEA and Oceania.
And considering we're in Oceania, you'd think we know what EMEA is. Like, yeah.
Emeria?
That was atrocious.
That was terrible.
So it turns out that if you Google it, EMEA means Europe, Middle East and Africa.
There you go.
EMEA.
Because they are so lazy at From, they couldn't actually write out full words.
Well, maybe they just wanted us. Maybe they wanted their players to learn through us what EMEA means.
Dark Souls.
Why did you say Dark Souls at the end?
Because it's a Dark Souls moment. Don't give you anything up front. You got to dig for the lore.
As Vardy always says, your interpretation is as good as mine, so maybe it's not that. Maybe Ethiopia, Madrid.
East Asia.
Yeah, East Asia. Maybe. On the 11th of April at 9 a.m. we'll find out.
Save the date. Okay. Now, before we go on, we have discussed our spoiler policy in the past. I just want to slightly amend it expand on it, just so people understand where we're coming from and those that have picked up the podcast in the last couple of episodes and didn't listen to the first few. Basically, we're going to be playing through the game in, at the moment, the order as set out by From themselves when you go to the travel screen. So you all would have seen when you bring up the travel screen, they have the different bonfires you can spawn to and they're in a specific order. At the moment, we're pretty much going to be playing through the game in that order and taking each area one by one and hitting all of the minutia for that area, but not going into things that you're going to see later on in the game. So don't be put off. If you haven't finished the game yet, we're not going to be spoiling stuff that's later on in the game. It's kind of going to be a play the area, listen to the episode. I think that's probably the best way to come at it.
I agree.
You can even look, if you're keen, it's going to be a slow playthrough, but you could even start a new character and play each new area as we discuss it live. It's the kind of thing where we're not going to go too far ahead. Some spoilers are unavoidable, but for the most part, we're going to be conscious of that stuff.
Yep.
Cool. So, comments from last step.
Yeah, so Brian raised with us that perhaps the statue in the Cardinal Tower bonfire could be a firekeeper. I mean, she's right by the bonfire, watching over it, and she's a woman, which all the firekeepers are.
Yeah, so last episode we talked about that statue by the Cardinal Bonfire, and that was our listener question for the week. And I found this one to be the most interesting, one that I didn't consider. It might be an homage to the firekeeper that used to tend that fire.
Yeah.
Mm. And we also had a comment from Steve, who said that he didn't summon Pate at the last giant boss fight. And which
neither did I don't think.
Yeah, well, we said that you've got to summon Pate to progress his storyline. And it turns out we've had a couple of confirmations now that if you don't summon him for that boss fight, it's fine. The difference is if you do summon him and keep him alive throughout the boss fight, the next time you see him, he's going to give you
his spear, his armor, and his shield, which is extremely generous if you think about it.
I don't know, comrades in war?
Yeah, but it's like, hey, I'll just get naked and give you all the shit I'm relying on to stay alive.
Okay, yeah, I suppose that's fair. So, yeah, take him into the boss fight, make him survive, you get all his stuff.
Make him survive. He's got no choice. I'll make you survive.
It's harder than you think. You said you didn't invite him in, but, like, he loves getting under that goddamn giant's feet. He's a sucker for pain. So, hey, before we go too far, I think we should apologize for not releasing exactly on the week. We're trying to release weekly, and I think we missed the mark this time, but
it's my fault. I bought a house, you see. You buy a house, it's just the most stressful thing in the freaking world, you know. Like, every idiot wants to call you. Do you have enough deposit? Is the finance too, you know, is the interest rate too high? Everyone wants to organize insurance and
I wasn't going to go into any of that stuff. I was just going to say, congratulations, you just bought your first house and I think you are excused at least to some degree for not being as available.
That's why we took a little longer than usual, but in the next kind of 30 years, I'm not going to buy anything that costs more than $50, so I won't be buying a house again. So that won't happen again. So, Jamin, show me your tips. He actually did it. He actually showed me his weird little nipple.
The benefit of recording in the same room rather than over Skype.
Yeah, and the thing about it is this, right? There's a little bit of wispy kind of infant's hair on his chest.
I've been a man for years.
Yeah, and not around his nipple, though. It's like someone with caustic saliva sucked on his... Oh, no, I'm wrong. He showed me again. It's only on his nipple. Ugh. It's disgusting. It's like I said, hair replacement therapy, but just on his nipple. And it's this weird, wispy little, like...
Fuck ugh. You. Like am I hair, going to have like to link hair, a picture of my nipple?
No, don't. The hair on a newborn baby's head. That's what it looks like. Can I... Oh, there's a photo now. There's a... Anyway, let's just move on. Let's just move on. So I'll talk to my therapist about it later.
Awful segue to tips.
Yep.
So... As we do each week, we've got some more beginner tips, and obviously as we go on, we're going to be releasing more and more episodes, and we're going to run out of fewer and fewer beginner tips, so the beginner tips will start turning into more advanced or sort of more technical, technically advanced suggestions on things you can try, I guess, but for now, we still have some stuff that we think everyone should know.
Exactly, so there might not be the biggest tips in the world, but shapely.
What's the first one, Church?
Should not record with my girlfriend in the room. Okay, so firstly, all rings can be repaired, even the ones that say they're going to break. Now, in the previous game, there were rings that you could equip, and then once they've fulfilled their purpose, they break and they're gone forever.
Mm.
In this game, you can repair them. It's bloody expensive to repair them, but those ones can be repaired.
Yeah, not prohibitively slow when you get old. Get older.
Not prohibitively slow when you get old.
Not prohibitively so as you go up the levels. However, yeah, you can repair even the rings that are designed to break. There will just be a cost involved, and they're more expensive than most other sort of armors that you can get repaired at the blacksmiths.
Now, this one I find really interesting. This is the kind of thing I've always wanted to see in video games, and I love it. If you have a weapon and you strike at your opponent, where on the weapon the opponent is impacted has an effect on the damage dealt. And that kind of makes sense.
Just so we're clear, I don't know, you sort of phrased it in a way that might be confusing some. We're not talking about like hitboxes where if you hit them in the head, it'll do this, and if you hit them in the leg, it'll do less. Yeah, I'm talking about
which part of the weapon impacts the opponent.
Yeah, it's actually called direct hit system.
So one time this guy swings his golf club at me, and it got me on like the shoulder back area, and it didn't really hurt because it wasn't the clubby end bit that got me. It was the like the lightweight sticky bit. You know, not sticky, but shaped like a stick. And that's kind of what I'm talking about, is that, for example, if you have a hammer and you strike the opponent and it's the, or a halberd is a better example.
Yeah, halberd's a perfect example. It's all about the distance from the enemy.
So you got to find the right range, and it's quite realistic. The bit of the halberd that does the chopping actually has to chop the opponent. If the staff hits them, then they just don't take as much damage. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, so this one actually confused me because it's not as prevalent in the previous game. Demon Souls, I think it was, but Dark Souls, not so much. So I kept wondering why sometimes I would attack an enemy and I would do 160 hits of HP and then like I'll die and go back and attack the exact same freaking enemy, and unbeknownst to me, I'm sort of copping him on the end part of my swing rather than the middle part of my swing or what have you, and I'm only doing like 100 points of damage. It didn't mesh with me at first. Now that I understand the system, it's actually supremely cool. So
awesome.
Hitting things at the peak of the swing rather than right at the start of the swing and hitting things at the right distance is going to do the most damage output. So keep that in mind. It's all about distance. And the last tip that we want to hit is the weight system in the game. In the previous game, as we all know, once you hit certain breakpoints, it would change the way you moved. So 25% and below, you're going to be doing these nice quick rolls. Anywhere between 25% and 50%, you're sort of doing the mid rolls, and then anything past 50%, I think you're doing.
The upshot is that 70% is the breakpoint where you fat roll, as you put it, roll.
Yeah, so anything past 70% weight in this game is going to make you fat roll. So if you can stay under that 70% weight breaking point, then you're going to be able to do the quick rolls. Now, everyone's aware of that, I'm sure. Like anybody that's experimented with weight in the game at all would be aware of that. What they probably don't realize, though, is anything below 70% is actually a sliding scale. So it's not just I'm under 70%, great, I'm fine, I can quick roll. If you're at 69% and then you drop all of your weight to get to 20%, there's actually a noticeable difference in the speed at which you can roll and move and jump and all of that. So basically the takeaway from this is if you're walking around with three weapons in your left hand and right hand slot and you're only ever using a shield and a sword, we'll drop the other four weapons because you just don't need them. They're just taking up extra weight and you will notice that you can suddenly roll, although not a lot, a bit faster.
Yes. Well, what do you want me to say? I agree with you.
Excellent. Shall we go on to the episode?
Yes. I think we've wasted more than enough time faffing around. Record.
Hades Tower of Flames.
Yeah. What do you think of it?
I like it. To be honest, this is probably my favorite area.
Really?
So fun. Not favorite, most impactful area.
Impactful. Yeah, I kind of remember you saying you didn't like it much. That it was, I think you called it a cheap knockoff of Anor Londo.
I don't remember.
Well, you did.
Okay. Well, look, I liked it. I walked out from Majula. So you've got to go down the spiral staircase, which is below the stone that makes everything more difficult.
You're talking about the Champion Stone?
Yeah, the Champion Stone. So the spiral staircase underneath the Champion Stone, you can head down there and you'll get to sort of like a sewerway, and there'll be a ring pool on a wall, which is so easy to miss. How do you go find
it? Honestly, I went down there a few times and I was like, oh, this will open up for me later. And I just left. And
yep.
I was kind of out of places to go, and I went down there out of desperation and then noticed the ring pool. So it's like, yeah, it's not made obvious.
No, I complained about the lever to get to the Forest of the Fallen Giants last episode and you laughed at me. This time, I think we both agree.
Yeah, this time I'm actually not going to pay out on you.
So for anyone that is at a bit of a loss as to the directions they can go, you can go to Hades Tower of Flame right from the get-go. The moment you hit Majula, you just have to be observant enough to notice the big ring pool on the wall that lifts the gate. Now, we also discussed last episode how we sort of toyed with the idea that Majula may be separated from the rest of the realm in a way that kind of makes it distinct from those other areas, and that might be why there's this prohibition sort of a doorway or gateway between each area.
I mean, I thought we got rid of prohibition in the 30s, but...
Prohibitive? So this time around, one thing that I did notice is if you do the ring pull and you sort of hang around the area for about a minute or longer, eventually the gate does go down again, which sort of adds to that idea that it could be something to it. You know, the gate doesn't stay open once you've opened it once. It does want to keep closing.
It's sort of the natural state of the world to separate the jeweler from. Yeah, you might be onto something. Or maybe it's some other reason. I wonder, though, if you stand under it, does it kill you?
Yeah, I was actually tempted to try, but it took so long to close each time. I just didn't want to try it again. I want to check out Hades Tower of Flames. So you walk out of the little passageway or the sewer way, and you end up in the opening, which gives you this incredible vista of this crumbling world with the Tower of Flames just completely opposite you and all these things just falling apart, and you're surrounded by sea, and it's just beautiful.
It does look absolutely excellent and kind of familiar.
Yeah, so I think that's the first thing that strikes you. Anyone that played the previous game will see that it's very reminiscent of Anor Londo. And I don't think that's a mistake, to be perfectly honest. And I think we'll cover that in depth throughout this episode. So what you see first when you come outside is, the Tower of Flame itself, which I think a few people might miss because you got to kind of look up. It's this big spire that comes out of the ground, and the top part is, sure enough, like full of flames. And I don't know, is it a lighthouse? Is it, what is it?
Well, I believe it serves as a lighthouse now.
Yeah, so that's the common belief at the moment. It's serving as a lighthouse to keep wayward ships away from danger or the rocky forms that have come from the
crumbling town. Well, there's a city under there, isn't there? Yeah. It's like a reef only.
Hmm. And also they sort of suggest that it's a way to lead you to the Way of the Blue, which is the covenant of the area, and it has a very strong presence in this area. And again, we'll be touching on that quite a bit throughout this episode.
Also, upon entering the area, you can actually see the bonfire.
Like, straight away, but it's so easy to miss. I actually missed it the first time. How about you?
Yeah, no, I didn't see it the first time either.
Yeah, I sort of immediately saw the first enemy, and literally, like, meters from the first enemy is the first bonfire for the area, which is going to be the main starting point whenever you die for now. And it's, yeah, very easy to miss. It just sort of goes off to the right down some stairs, but... Mm. I guess the entry to the stairway isn't obvious and as it could be.
So down a ruined path and up to face your first enemy in the area.
Mm. I also think it's probably worth pointing out, if you turn around at this point, you can see Majula from where you are. I find that incredibly interesting.
I think that's cool.
It's always been like that with the Dark Souls games. Like you could see your blood stain in Lost Izalith when you were in complete other areas of the game looking down. It was miles away. You would see different things. Everything was sort of interconnected. And it seems that way as well with this game. But the scale doesn't quite seem fully right at the moment to me. For example...
But surely they don't have some kind of non-Newtonian or Euclidean thing going on. It's just that it looks funny.
No, I don't know. I actually think there might be. I mean, yeah, I don't know. You guys figure it out for yourselves. But from Majula, you go down that spiral staircase and through, like, what, 15 meters of sewerway, and then you enter into the Tower of Flame area. But if you look back, it's miles off on the distance on a cliff face, you know. It's not nearby at all. It just doesn't quite seem right. So I'm not sure if there's something to that or...
It might be a reinforcement of that idea that Majula is somehow separate from everything else. It's possibly. Like you pass between dimensions when you move to Hades Tower of Flame.
Yeah, all right. So we'll keep working on that theory, and so far everything seems to sort of mesh with that. So who knows? There might be something to it.
So the first enemy, a giant dude, and these guys are called Old Knights. And I actually think the sword fighting against these guys, I mean, I'm normally a caster, but I like to pull out my sword against these guys because it's so much fun.
Yeah, and why wouldn't you? I mean, Anal Londo, or Anal Rodeo, as I like to call it.
Why?
Because it was a friggin' ass raping the first time you got there. The sentinels in the area were hardcore, to the point where this area, as we said, you can go to as a first area. It's a little bit hard, but it fits perfectly well as a second area, and the enemies are actually quite easy. But compared to the enemies in Anal Londo, I mean, Christ, they put out an ass whooping. But these guys, I mean, they pack a punch, but they're very easy to not get hit by.
Yeah, and once you work out the trick, it's just the simplest thing in the world. Just
stay behind them all.
Yeah, move to their right. No, sorry, your right, their left, their shield hand.
Yeah, just stay close and they'll miss you. If you're standing around their feet, they're probably going to whiff past you with every strike.
Yep, just whiff on past, whatever the fuck that means.
Okay, so the old knights in the area, there's a couple of different kinds. One holds the whole sword and board, one that holds an ultra great sword, and one that holds a massive mace. Now, there is actually only one that holds a mace, and that's the second enemy for the area.
Absolutely.
And he only spawns once. He doesn't come back, and he actually serves a really important purpose. The first time you kill him, he will drop Sublime Bone Dust.
Oh, I knew what it was.
You're an ass. Just make me read my notes. God damn it. So he drops Sublime Bone Dust.
And I think that Sublime Bone Dust is extremely interesting.
From a lore perspective, possibly one of the more important things you'll pick up.
Sure. So the description of the Sublime Bone Dust says...
Charred ashen bones. Cast them into the Farfire and Majula to increase the HP restored with each use of your flask. So putting it straight out there, go to Majula, put the bones in the fire, get more health out of each Estus.
And worth noting, the existing bonfire is already made of bones.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good point. What are you trying to say with that?
Oh, I'm just... I actually think there's some kind of... We all know that the bonfire is magic, and also actually fire itself has some kind of significance to the lore of the entire Souls universe. I mean, the whole entire purpose of the first game was about rekindling a flame, and they talk really affectionately about fires, and particularly in this game. But the fire itself is made out of the life force of others, it seems. It's the bones of the undead.
I never actually picked up on that. I've always observed that, yeah, the bonfire is made out of bones. I actually made a papercraft version of a bonfire and, you know, painstakingly cut out heaps of these bones to stick on the bottom to make it a bonfire from Dark Souls. I never really picked up that bones aren't really flammable. So why did they go with that for a choice? I suppose, yeah, there's something to that. I never thought of it.
Yeah, and I actually kind of think, if you think about in the first game, the way that the first flame was kindled, which was by the casting of oneself into the flame, and they call it the first flame, which kind of suggests all the other flames stemmed from that flame. And they even show the kind of furtive pygmy in the beginning holding this flame in this really kind of...
protective.
Yeah, it's like it's his own little secret, and... it's like it's incredibly precious. And I think there's a suggestion that all flame in the world came from that first flame. So the idea that the first flame runs on flesh and all bonfires in this world run on bones.
I guess I've always known that. I just never really fully made that connection. It was kind of like a glass shattering moment then. That's
something interesting there anyway.
Yeah. So as we said, you cast the bone dust into the fire at Majula. And it's important that you use the bonfire at Majula. It won't work at any other bonfire to reinforce your Estus.
Yeah, something's going on with that bonfire.
Yeah.
Do you know what I think it is?
Go on.
My theory is that's the only bonfire with a firekeeper.
Okay, I think we actually discover a bit more about it towards the end of the game. So we're obviously not there yet. So at the moment, we will leave it with a big, not sure, but obviously that fire is important for some reason. And I'm sure we'll be coming back to that towards the end of the game. But it's the next part of the actual item description that's important. So I read out the first part. The next part says,
they say these are the remains of a saint who cast himself into the bonfire, but we will never know for sure, for soot and ashes tell no story.
Incredibly poetic, but let's just grasp that for a second.
Just grasp it.
These are the remains of a saint who cast himself into the bonfire. What comes to mind immediately when we read that?
Well, I often think about the chosen undead from the first game.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That's the first thing that came to my mind. Maybe they're myself.
Did Gwyn not cast himself into the flame?
That was my next thought. So my first thought was, these may be the ashen remains of my last playthrough in the previous game. Like, I cast myself into the bonfire. Mm. But if you go with that theory, then you have to accept that the ending of the previous game that has followed on to this game was the one where you cast yourself into the bonfire. You rekindled that last flame.
Mm.
And the big part of the last game was you were given that choice throughout. I mean, Karth and Seath, like, their entire purpose throughout the game was to try and sway you one way or another. So it was very important that you had that choice. So to force that choice on you now by saying that they are yourself from the previous game or the undead from the previous game would mean that we have to accept,
sure,
that the previous game ended with somebody casting themselves into the fire.
But we know, yes, as I said, that Gwyn cast himself into the fire, and we also find out in this game that others have attempted the same thing.
Yes.
I'm specifically talking about something that happens later, so in a later episode we'll readdress that. But we know that the attempt by an undead to rekindle the first flame is not something that's isolated to Gwyn and the chosen undead from Dark Souls.
So, absolutely, there have been people that have rekindled that first flame previously. You weren't the first, you were probably the last in the Dark Souls game, but yeah, they could be the ashen remains of Gwyn, Solaire, anyone really, we don't know. So moving up from there, we encounter a third old knight, and we're not going to go into a blow-by-blow for every single one of these, but so far each one has been significant in their own right. So the third one, when you walk up the stairs and out the archway, the first thing he does is he goes into this defensive guard right over an area, and I feel as though he's protecting the lever that comes up when you kill him. So you enter into a battle with him, and if you kill him, this lever raises out of the ground. And interestingly, if you get there quick enough, you can stand on top of it and get raised by this lever. Get raised by the lever.
I've heard of people raised by wolves, but raised by leather? Like, what a boring freaking upbringing. Leather doesn't do anything, and it looks good.
So it's completely useless, but if, you know, you want to feel that extra 3 feet taller, then you can stand on top of the lever. Now, the game could cause you to miss the lever, or if you think, shit, I don't want to take on these mobs, I'm just going to run straight past them, you may miss the lever and not pull it. So the importance of these levers, though, and you see it very clearly, is when you do it from where you're standing, directly opposite you is the Tower of Flame, or the base of the Tower of Flame, and you see these levels raising up out of the ground. So the first lever raises the first sort of inner ring for that area, and that's important for the boss fight, because you're going to come to the first boss for the area, but if you don't pull this lever, that fight is a hell of a lot harder.
And the reason for that is that raising that platform, giving you more ground to run around on, and a boss that has so much pushback is going to shove you off an edge if you don't have a lot of space to move around in.
I actually experimented with that on my second character. I sort of thought, I wonder if anything interesting happens if I don't raise the floor and take him on and kill him. And yeah, sure enough, my first fight, he hit me once and knocked me all the way back, even though I was shielding, and I just fell straight into the ocean.
So how did you beat him that time? Did you have to pull the levers?
Disappointingly, I pulled one, but I'm confident that nothing happens if you don't pull both of them and you do defeat him. So I wasn't too bothered at that point. I just wanted to do it for a personal challenge. But yeah, I ran out of time, so I just ended up pulling one and raised the inner ring and sort of took him on. But it was still fun. Okay, so from here, you can actually see the arena that you're going to take on the boss, and you see the floor raising, but you can also actually see the boss, and you can do damage to him from outside of the arena.
Isn't that crazy? Like, that, nothing like that happened in any of the other, in Dark Souls 1.
Ah, I don't agree.
What happened?
Ah, Betty.
Are you talking about the butterfly?
Betty is nodding knowingly in the corner. Oh, are we talking about the... I can actually think of two things. There's Manus, where when you're about to take on Manus, right outside his door, you can kind of see deep into the abyss, and you can see two very, very small pixels, which are his eyes, and you can start peppering him with arrows from there. And
that's
you can
quite cool.
Actually defeat him without ever entering the room, which totally a cheesing way of killing him, but fuck, he's a hard boss, so I could forgive anyone that does it, to be perfectly honest.
And what's the other one? Are you talking about the demons in the beginning?
No, I'm thinking of the Taurus demon. No.
I don't think the Taurus... You mean the one that you fight on the
Taurus
wall?
Taurus demon. What's the one with the dogs? Blank.
Capra demon.
Yes, I'm thinking of the Capra demon. You can stand outside his room and throw dung pies over the wall and just kill him with toxic.
Whoa, that sounds like the kind of thing I did when I was a kid.
Yeah, you can be like a monkey at a zoo and just throw shit at the guy over the wall. It's terrible. What a way to die. I mean, seriously.
You'd be, because it must hurt a lot, right, to take off enough health that it kills you. So you'd be sprinting around covered in shit going, oh God, it keeps landing on me.
Oh, yeah, man.
That wouldn't be good.
The most shameful way of death.
Yep.
So with this boss, though, while we can do damage to him outside of his arena, you can't actually kill him.
Yeah, he turns towards you and raises his shield, the wuss.
So right near to this third old knight that you defeat, and the lever, there's actually a Lloyd's Talisman that you can pick up, and I found its placement kind of a bit interesting. I didn't know too much about the Lloyd's Talismans from the previous game, aside from what they were used for, but Lloyd himself, I learnt only recently. His name is Allfather Lloyd, and he's actually Gwyn's uncle.
Yeah, how that works, I don't quite know, because it's almost kind of implied that in the opening cinematic of Dark Souls 1, that Gwyn is a deity, or some kind of constant of the universe, almost. At least that's the way I interpreted it.
Right, and I guess the way I'm seeing it now is kind of in the same way as the Greek gods. You know, you've got Zeus. Wait, you've got Odin, who's
no,
the father.
That's a Norse god. Zeus. Well, I always confuse my Greek and my Roman gods, but Zeus is a Greek god, I believe.
You've got Zeus, the god of Thor.
The god of what?
Thor.
THAW?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that what Zeus was? Huh. Do you make that up?
I don't know. I just watched the movie recently. I feel like we should
what
know
movie?
This.
What movie?
Thor.
You mean T-H-O-R?
Thor.
But in an Australian accent, Thor, T-H-A-W, which means cold things getting warmer.
What
and
fucking god is called Thor to defrost?
What? No, but hang on a minute. So you're saying, how is one god the god of another god? It's like saying, oh, Jesus, the god of Yahweh or some bullshit. Listen, Thor, T-H-O-R, is a Norse god, like Odin, right?
Odin.
He's the hammer guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Zeus, who is not the god of Thor any more than he's the god of Mercury or the god of Mars, right? Is a fucking Greek god.
Fuck, I'm showing my ignorance of history here.
It's not history, it's mythology. It's just general ignorance. Anyway, I imagine that you had a point.
Yes.
I'm hoping.
Thor, Odin's son.
Yes.
There you go. So Odin is the father of Thor.
Yes.
Not Zeus.
Zeus, the god of Thor.
Oh, man.
You mean THAW? Yes.
Right. So either way, the point I was making is I assume that the gods were, to some extent, no different to humans in so much as they had family units. You had the uncle, you had the son, you had the daughter, Gwynzelin, Guinevere. Makes sense.
Okay.
That's the only point I was making. Yeah.
Well,
but.
You could have just said, maybe gods can have relatives.
You're right.
And I wouldn't have thought you were as stupid as I now think you are.
You're right. So, back to the point I was making. Lloyd's Talisman, you can pick it up here, and I feel that that is relevant because, as we're going to expand on more and more throughout this episode, I feel as though this area is a nod to Anor'londo in more ways than just its appearance.
Absolutely. From there into a large round room, beautiful stained glass windows with three old knights in it, and the way they act is really interesting. When you appear and engage them, you kind of get the opportunity to fight the guy in the middle with the greatsword. And I never really picked up on it, but if you look closely, what happens is the other two actually move to the doors.
Yeah, they retreat and they defend their exits.
And so if you rush in there and attack them, what they're doing is keeping you contained, I guess, while you fight with their friend. But obviously that means that since they go and do that, you can draw their friend out.
Yeah.
And kill him. And then they panic and think, oh shit, what have we done?
Yeah, they all come and attack you. So it's as though it's like, yeah, we think our friend can take him. We'll just defend our exit so he can't get away. And then once you take him out, they're like, well, I guess we got no choice but to go balls to the wall.
And that's
now
how it should be, right? Because if some idiot wants to fight with your friend should be able to look after his bloody self. And you shouldn't have to gang up on him like a wuss. But if someone kills your friend, you've got an obligation to go and kill him.
So, you take out the three old knights in this room, and when you do, another lever raises from the ground. And again, raising another section of the arena that you're very shortly going to take the Dragon Rider on in.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It is a very short period of time. Like, it's actually quite a small level, isn't it?
It is. And to the point where, when we said that we're going to do this area for this episode, I sort of thought to myself, well, shit, there's no way we're going to be able to fill a whole episode with just that area. It's almost insignificant. But it's definitely lore-rich, and I think more so than a lot of other areas, but I guess that might just be my assumptions now, and we'll get to the next area and think, oh, there's no way I could fill an episode with that, and same thing will happen.
Yep. Okay, so if you go out the door on your right at this stage,
mm-hmm.
you can go down some stairs that are to your right, outside that door, and you'll find a little platform. It's kind of falling to bits, but there's a chest on your right full of junk.
Yeah, it's only full of green blossom, but I like the layout. It really enforces this idea that the city is falling apart. All that remains is those that were on these reinforced pillars, and everything that didn't have something supporting it underneath has long since fallen into the ocean.
Yeah, very cool. You can also, if you are a human, summon an NPC here.
Masterless Glencore. Super cool name, I think. How do you feel about Glencore?
Glencore? You think that's a cool name? Sounds like a product you use to freshen the odor in your house.
Fair enough.
It does.
Yeah.
No, I'd use that.
I don't disagree. You can summon Masterless Glencore. There's no real lore behind this guy, to the best of what I can see. There's almost no mention of him whatsoever anywhere other than right here as a summon.
He's just some dude with a big sword.
Yeah, but the internet has kind of fallen in love with him like they did with Tarkus. They're calling him the new Tarkus because he comes with this awesome greatsword and a big shield, and he's a tank, basically, and so he can almost do the fight by himself. For those that don't know, Iron Tarkus was the summon that you could have for the Iron Golem boss fight, and he could almost just take the guy on entirely by himself. So the other interesting thing with Masterless Glencore is that his summon sign, while outside the Dragon Rider boss arena, you can summon him there and you can make him follow you all the way to the second boss of the area as well. So just bear that in mind. If you're struggling with the second boss, maybe clear out the area, make it a safe path, go down, summon Masterless Glencore and take him in with you to the second boss, which we will address in a minute.
Yeah.
But Dragon Rider, walk in and you are greeted by
a big, huge, fat guy.
How'd you feel about this guy?
I actually enjoyed fighting him, but that's because it was actually
so fucking easy.
Yeah, it was I killed him the first time.
Yep, so did I.
The thing with the fog door is, like, if you can summon an NPC outside, it's a good indication that there's a boss there. But I was undead at the time. I couldn't summon the NPC when I first faced this guy. So you see the fog door and you think, probably there's a boss behind there. I hadn't seen him from a distance either. But it might just be a new area, because sometimes that's what the fog door is, just a new area in the level. And so you open the door, there's a boss there. You think, okay, now I'm in a boss fight. Wonderful. Next thing I know, he was dead. I mean, that wouldn't stand up in court. But what I'm saying is that I just thought, oh, well, I'll just try to work out the trick and see if I can beat him next time or whatever.
Yeah.
He was pretty easy.
Yeah, pretty much his only gimmick is if you didn't raise the floor. If you've raised the floor, it's such a pushover. Like, this guy is no harder than what you would expect a mob to be, basically, except he's just got a hell of a lot more health.
Yeah, he's a particularly tough mob.
Now, I've got to say, it's almost disappointing because his background and what you can learn about the Dragon Riders, because they're actually a class of fighter that were in the Fendrick's army. So the lore surrounding him is supremely cooler than the actual fight with him. If you had have read this stuff before entering the fight somehow, you would almost be put off because he sounds like a complete freaking badass. These are a class of warrior that basically trained to ride these worms, WYRMS, which is, I wikied it, is another name for European mystical dragons, basically.
I think it's a particular kind of Scandinavian, Nordic kind of thing, actually.
Which, I gotta say, it's from refusing to call a dragon a dragon. What have they gone through already? We've got drakes, wyverns, dragons.
Well, I think a wyvern is a different thing. I think a drake is a type of dragon, but I think a wyvern is like, it's like part lion, part scorpion or some bullshit like that. That's a manticore I'm thinking of, but you know what I mean. It's some kind of, it's a compound animal, like a compound word.
Nonetheless, I mean, we've now got worms, but these are dragon.
We've rivals. Now got worms. I think there's like a pill you can take for that or something.
So these dragon riders, they
we've now got worms.
Can you let me finish my sentence? All right,
fine. My ass is itchy. I can't help it. Oh god, that was got to get rid of that. Anyway, yeah, okay, just move on.
Their description: they were actually feared amongst the battlefields for their unparalleled strength. These are a class of enemy that have trained perilously so to subdue and master these dragons so that they could ride them into battle. And if they failed their training, they would actually get torn to bits by the same dragon they tried to tame. I mean,
yeah, man, that's freaking awesome. Anyway, so you smack that guy around.
Yep, defeat the boss, get his soul item. And look, at this point, let's have a quick chat. I think everyone probably realizes at some point the item description for all the boss souls explains it anyway, that you can either burn the soul for a heap of souls, or you can use it to exchange for an item.
Yeah, well, it says or else ... But if you've ever played the previous game, and if you're not a prat, then you'll understand that you can trade it for items. So do we go into it or not? I think we should go into it.
I think it's worth pointing out, look, we're not going to go into detail, but so far from this point on, I think any time we get a boss soul, we'll just let you guys know you can trade the boss souls for items. Here's the items you can get. We're not going to tell you any info or lore or anything more about the items other than that's what you can get. So at least you guys are informed. So you can sort of go, well, I'm not interested in any of those items. I may as well burn it for the souls
and
right now.
You know what? That's what my housemate's been doing. See, I'm stunned by that because I want to pick up the items. I like to have unique items.
Even though I know that I'm not going to use 90% of them.
Yeah, no, me either. But my housemate just gets the fights the boss, gets the souls, picks up the boss's soul, eats that too.
Gotta say, he's probably on something. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, sure, you're going to miss out on a heap of cool items, but he's going to level up much quicker. He's probably going to use those extra souls to level up whatever good weapon he's using already anyway. So, yeah, sure, he might maybe not get access to some cool weapons, but for the main part, he's going to be fine by doing
it. Yeah, but the thing is, you can get an infinite number of souls. You can't get an infinite number of...
Yeah, I agree. But you do get another chance, I suppose, in New Game Plus. So, okay, so with that in mind, you get the Dragon Rider's soul, and you can trade it later on in the game for the Dragon Rider's halberd, the Dragon Rider's twin blade, the Dragon Rider's bow, or the Dragon Rider's great shield. There. That's it. That's all we'll say.
So then, up the stairs, and you go to the second bonfire. You also find Lycia, which I think is a nice name, actually.
Yeah, for a heinous woman.
My name is Lycia. I have come to spread the art of miracles, a practice of which I am a disciple. Why did I come here? Well, do I need any other reason than to spread the gospel of miracles? My preceptor always said this art should be shared with the world. And such is my only wish.
I can't stand this. Like, in this episode, I think we're going to meet my least favorite NPC and possibly my most favorite NPC.
You like that Lucatiel, don't you?
Lucatiel, yeah. She's definitely one of my favorites.
They're both nice names, but I like Lycia's name better.
We'll expand on Lucatiel definitely right at the end of the episode. Now, Lycia, I can't stand this woman.
So she's a cleric out of Lindelt, which is a land that's famous for its miracles.
And she explains herself basically is on a pilgrimage to sort of spread the wonders of miracles. And you can already hear the malice in my voice. I mean, she's basically around to spread her knowledge or her love of miracles to other people and get other people interested and excited about miracles as well. But she does it in such a snaky sort of con man-y kind of way. She just seems so underhanded. She just seems driven by a desire for souls, and she'll do whatever she can
all to get them. Undead have a desire for souls.
Sure, but there's some NPCs that are nice. There's some NPCs that you can understand why they are the way they are with her.
What do you think about Gilligan?
Who's Gilligan?
Oh, never mind.
I don't know who Gilligan is.
Okay, never mind. Well, it's past this anyway, so we shouldn't be talking about it, but yeah, it's interesting.
Maybe I do know Gilligan. Who's Gilligan?
He's the guy that goes, "Shush, quiet, you Egypt. I'm on the run."
Yes. Oh, I remember Gilligan. Yes, I like Gilligan.
He's just completely soul hungry. All he cares about is souls.
Yeah, but he puts it out there. He doesn't make any excuse about it. So I can.
He's full of excuses. He's a bullshit artist.
Maybe.
He's a lying, underhanded scumbag.
I kind of feel like it's fine because he's upfront about it. You know his intentions. With Lycia, I mean, she even has the dialogue. One of the last things she says to you is she sort of lets slip. This area is sort of deplete of people to sell things to and talk to. So I'm going to have to move on because there's nobody here that I can gull the, help the gullible.
Yeah. And if you don't know, gull isn't just a noun meaning an annoying bird that once pooped on a birthday cake I had and made me go ballistic. Like, really, I'm eating my birthday cake on the beach and a gull came and pooped on it. And because I'm neurotic, I couldn't eat any of the cake.
How old were you?
Like 8.
Oh, my God.
Scarred for life. I hate gulls. Anyway, it's also a verb meaning, to trick someone, particularly someone who's, like, weak of mind. So that's where the word gullible comes from, able to be gulled.
Mm, and so she let slip, but it was no mistake that word choice. You know, she's basically saying, I'm here to spread this knowledge of miracles to anyone that I can trick into buying them off me.
Yeah, but, I mean, come on, aren't all the merchants doing that?
I know, but... Once again, like, I just feel like they're upfront about it.
Like, at least miracles are actually amazing. Like, they're miraculous.
Sure. So, she actually sells some pretty cool things. The first of which is the Ring of Prayer.
Listen to that. Hook, line, and sinker. Oh, those things are awesome. I really want to give her my soul.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Ring of Prayer. Christ, 28,000 souls to buy this. It ain't cheap. And sure, it's cool. It raises your faith by 5 points, but 28,000 souls. You could spend that on 5 level ups in faith right now.
Yeah, I suppose you could.
And she also sells a heap of miracles, a heap of healing miracles, and some other cooler ones like the lightning spear, which...
Yeah, which is awesome. If you've ever played PvP, you know how horrible that is. I've been lightning spear to death a bunch of times, particularly in the first game.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's a good miracle. It's one of the few offensive miracles from the previous game. But the reason this one's so cool is because it's so obviously a nod to Solaire, and who doesn't love Solaire from
the previous game? How's it a nod to Solaire?
Have you read the item description?
I have.
Said to be the legacy of an ancient clan whose leader was revered as the God of Sun. The name of the clan has been lost to time, but the gross incandescence of our magnificent father shall never wane. Come on. It doesn't get any more clearer.
Explain. So you're suggesting the clan leader is Solaire? I don't remember Solaire ever running a clan. Are you talking about the Covenant?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
How much Dark Souls did
you
play,
I'm thinking about this the wrong way. That's all. Never mind.
And his gross incandescence? I mean, that's what Solaire's known for.
It's, yeah. Do you think Solaire also wanted to have sex with you?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I played a dude for at least half
my characters. Yeah, no, he doesn't care.
Yeah. Go hard, Solaire.
I could tell.
And another miracle moving right along that Lycia sells is Resplendent Life. This one has the item description, Cleric for Sale. Cleric for Sale? That's kind of how it's spelled. F-O-R-S-A-L-L-E.
No, it's either for sale or for Sali.
Cleric for Sale of Lindelt was a master of miracles who fought battles across the lands. His allies called him a holy knight, but his enemies feared him for his demonic powers.
What now, a beast.
Cleric for Sale. For Sale.
For Sale.
Whatever. That's, again, all the lore that we'll get about this guy. I've looked into it. There's nothing more. But God, he sounds like a badass. But his enemies feared him for his demonic powers. So cool.
That's awesome. Imagine if you had that going on, right? Imagine what your resume would look like.
Yeah.
It would just say, like...
Good team player, it would just say, demonic powers.
No, I would just say... Mine would just be, like... It would just be a few words. Scott Church, my enemies fear me for my demonic powers. Contact details.
See you next week. And the last miracle that I want to touch on that Lycia sells is Guidance. And the reason this one's cool is if you haven't experimented with it before, basically casting the miracle will, I guess, summon, for lack of a better word, orange soapstone messages that have been purposely left in the game by the developers. And they're not developing messages like behind the scenes type stuff, but they're things like if there's ever a illusory wall in an area or a wall that you can break, then there's going to be a message that will appear when you cast this spell somewhere near that wall that says search the area or something to the effect of that. And this is something you can do even when you're offline. So if you're not playing online because you just don't have the internet or you're a single player type person, then a spell like this can definitely be useful because it's going to point you in the right direction when you lack that extra benefit that you get from all the orange soapstone messages you get while playing online.
There you go.
Now, after you exhaust Lysia's dialogue, in any case, she moves on from this area and she'll eventually end up in the contraption room that you had to pass to get down to Hades Tower of Flame, which is right near Majula. And we'll cover that at the end of the episode, but it's the room that potentially leads to Huntsman's Copse.
Copse?
We're going to have one of these discussions again, aren't we?
Yeah, well, it's up to you whether you pronounce things right. I always said copse. I mean, I don't know. My housemate always says corpse, but I don't think that's just because he's misread it a little.
I noticed that, and I was going to correct him, but he just said it far too many times. I just thought, fuck it. Fine. I'll let him have that. Yeah, copse, I think, because copse just reminds me too much of pigs. So, from here, back to the big circular room where you took on the three old knights, and this time, instead of going out the right-hand door, which leads to the boss, you go out the left-hand door.
And the left-hand door takes you up towards the Cathedral of Blue. So before you get there, you have to fight a pair of sentinels standing outside the door.
Old knights, but yep.
Old knights, sentinels, whatever.
Still living in Dark Souls 1 age, bro.
Yeah, I know.
Get with the times.
We should have had a solo podcast called the Dark Souls 1 back in those days.
You would never have listened to it anyway.
No, I never listened to any podcast, including this one. I genuinely don't. It drives him nuts.
It's such a point of contention. I cut each episode for hours and he just won't even give me the time of day to listen to it.
I don't have the time of day. But besides, I know what was said. I was there, right? I don't need to listen to it. Anyway, so you're going up towards the Cathedral of Blue. You've got to fight a bunch of those old knights along the way. I think kiting those guys is a really good idea. If you've got the binoculars, you know, you can kite the guy towards you. And those two are no exception. One of them will engage you while the other one faffs around like an idiot.
Divide and conquer. Yeah. Absolutely. The method that works for these guys.
Yeah. So you kill those plebs and then you run up some stairs and there's another pleb and you got to kill that guy. And he's just a sword and board type dude. And again, you just circle around until you chop him to bits. And then another lever will appear.
Mm.
Activate the lever. And a massive drawbridge comes down. And the drawbridge animation, I think, is quite cool.
Oh, it's awesome. It's actually quite terrifying the first time I did it. Because I'm like, is this thing going to crush me? What's happening here? And yeah, it didn't take long. But eventually you realize that it's this awesome freaking drawbridge that leads you up to the Cathedral of Blue. But as soon as it crashes down, there's dust particles and the chains wobble. And yeah, it just looks really cool.
Do you reckon drawbridges were ever a real thing? And I'm sure they probably were. But I've never seen a picture of...
You're actually making yourself sound stupider than I did about the whole Odin and Zeus thing.
Just shut up a minute. Just listen. I've seen plenty of pictures of old castles and stuff. None of them had a drawbridge.
I don't believe it.
Well, I don't know. It's some kind of like thing of fiction that's like the Viking horned helmet that never really existed, but everyone just assumes it's true.
Okay, well, drawbridges, absolutely, I think, definitely must have existed.
Well, they had moats,
I was going to ask, what about moats? That seems more unlikely.
But a moat could just be a choke point. Like, the guys have to cross a bridge. You got an army of 5,000 people attacking you, and they've all got to come across a bridge that's two people wide. Easy as pie.
At the top of the drawbridge is one of the most important items in the game, in my opinion, to the point where on my second character, I actually did a suicide run just to get this item the moment I got to Majula.
Yeah, obviously, the Ring of Binding is amazing. It's a little bit like the Kling Rings from the previous game, and it's amazingly helpful.
Yeah. Anybody that's suffering with the game, obviously they're suffering because they die a lot, and a result of dying a lot means you're losing more and more health each time to the point of 50% health. The Ring of Binding...
Yes, the Ring of Binding.
God, I get confused.
Maintains you at worst case scenario 75% health.
Correct. So you're always going to be walking around with 75% health, nothing lost, 4 slots for rings this time. Why aren't you wearing it? I mean, there's no excuse.
Yes, honestly, I put it on and never taken it off. I've shuffled all my other rings around, but that's the one ring I will never take off. And until I'm a human, when you're a human, take it off straight away.
Yeah, or, you know, when you get good at the game.
Do you still wear it?
Yes.
There you go.
All right, and also, incidentally, in this chest is 5 effigies.
I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's nice help at this point, and rightly so. We mentioned last episode that if you strike wooden chests, all you get is rubbish, and the good items are always in a metal chest that you can't break. These items are in a metal chest. So, we're pretty much ready to enter the boss fight for the old Dragon Slayer.
Yeah, but before you get in there, don't forget that there is a divine blessing in the level that I forgot to mention to you earlier. The guys that we were talking about kiting and how they're plebs, to your left after you walk out that door, on a little stairway that's fallen into the sea, there is a divine blessing. The other thing you should bear in mind before you enter that fight is you can summon that masterless Glencore guy, who again sounds like a cleaning product, to help you. You have to trek a fair distance to get him, but he'll come and help you with this boss.
Yeah, so just keep that in mind if you're having any difficulty fighting on the old Dragon Slayer. But I think it's important to just touch on the fact that there's a Divine Blessing here. Each time we've come across a Divine Blessing so far, I feel like it's been relevant, and this time more so than any. And we're about to really hit home with that in a moment, because the old Dragon Slayer is...
Ornstein. I mean, that helmet is very distinctive.
Yeah, all of his armor is very distinctive, but he might not be Ornstein, but he's definitely meant to be Ornstein.
Well, there's some kind of relationship between this character and Ornstein. Now, what that looks like, we don't know. We know that a lot of what was going on around Ornstein's area in Dark Souls was holograms. Guinevere was a hologram. A lot of the sunlight in that area seems to have been a hologram generated by Guinevere.
Yeah, to the point where sometimes when you look up the sky, the sun isn't actually even there.
Yeah, it's just, there's just light.
It vanishes.
Now, you fight Ornstein before you enter that area. So it's a bit unclear. Is Ornstein part of the illusion? You do get his soul. And if you get his soul, that tells me that he's probably not an illusion, because the soul has a real effect, like all the other souls, which are presumably are real. So what does it mean that these two guys look so similar and have a similar fighting style?
I'm inclined to think it is Ornstein. We've mentioned a couple of times now in this episode the name Vardy. And those that don't know, Vardy is a guy that makes videos on Dark Souls lore on YouTube.
And yeah, a pretty cool guy, I think.
A huge following. He's dreamy. For the first time in like a year of making these videos, he released one where he actually showed his face. And good God, he's Ryan Gosling incarnate. But no need to touch on that.
Yeah, you can touch on yourself later by the sound of it.
I will. So he releases supremely cool videos about the lore, and he comes at them from a different angle. Now, nonetheless, all we're going to touch on is he has opinions about this, and I think they're quite founded. We know for fact that Ornstein and Smough were protectors of Guinevere. They were where they were in Anor Londo to stop the undead from getting to Guinevere.
Exactly. That was their role.
Precisely. So I'm of the mind that this Ornstein lookalike is actually Ornstein, whether it's reincarnate, whether it's some different version of him, but still him, because, well, for one, there's too many coincidences. You get the old Leo ring off him when you kill him, and you got the Leo ring from him in Dark Souls 1, so there's definitely a crossover there, but the only thing that's really changed is his armor has a different tinge to it. He's sort of silvery this time, whereas his armor was more gold in the last game. And he's using dark magic or hexes rather than lightning like he did in the last game.
Sure. And Vardy has his own theories about why he would do that, saying that lightning is an anti-dragon type weapon. Now he's in an area where people ride dragons habitually. So,
which I got to say, to have the old Dragon Slayer literally a couple of houses up from the Dragon Rider, kind of feels like a bit of conflict of interest there.
Yeah, I bet they were like always eyeing each other off in the corridors and stuff.
But wasted potential with the Dragon Rider though, right? Like, that boss fight could have been so much cooler if he came in riding a dragon. Fucking worm.
Yeah. Another possibility that I think people are... It's a bit lame, but people, and that's probably why people aren't considering it. Maybe they just wear the same armor.
Possibly. But look, here's my thoughts. The Hades Tower of Flame is definitely a nod to Anor Londo. The architecture is very similar.
The flying buttresses particularly.
Yep. So we know that Guinevere left Anor Londo, or fleed Anor Londo. Fled Anor Londo. I don't do word good. Fled Anor Londo during the end of the era with the last flame, and she fled with Flan. Flan was, in the previous game, Guinevere's husband, and he was the
God of Flame.
Yeah, and so Vardy hypothesizes that Hades Tower of Flame could be a monument to Flan. The architecture could be very similar to Anor Londo because it's been designed by Guinevere, and it's all she knows. She knew Anor Londo, and so she's made this new realm in the image of Anor Londo. We've got the Divine Blessing, which we know from the two previous episodes is very tightly tied to Guinevere. We've got Ornstein, or Ornstein lookalike, who we know his last purpose in life was to defend Guinevere. And not only this, but there's these two enormous statues in this arena, and they're actually repeated. There's the same two statues as you first walk into Hades Tower of Flame area, right before that first bonfire. And the thing that stands out with these statues to me is they've got this sort of bird of prey head. That's the first thing, and that seems to be a repeating theme throughout the game. There's a lot of statues with animal heads, but the main one is they're holding this sword, which definitely looks like the Great Lord Greatsword from the previous game. And for those that don't know, the Great Lord Greatsword was Gwyn's sword. And you could only get this sword in game by defeating Gwyn and trading his soul for this sword. So it's no mistake. I mean, this sword can't come about just because you had to have defeated Gwyn. You had to have used his soul to make it. It was definitely tied to Gwyn in some way. So the fact that these statues are holding this sword that looks almost identical in every way, I don't think it's a mistake. It's too much of a coincidence.
Yeah, look, I agree with you. And that's all I have to say about that. Actually, what did you think of the fight with the old Dragon Slayer?
Definitely harder than the Dragon Rider, but my first character, he was a pushover as well, but I think I was overpowered. I also came into both those fights with the Great Club, which was quite leveled up at the point, and the Great Club is a crushing weapon, and crushing weapons are great for enemies that are heavily armored, which both the Dragon Rider and Ornstein knockoff version 2.0 are wearing. So yeah, I was doing quite good damage on both of them. And with this fight anyway, he can be a little challenging, but same sort of a deal. Walk towards him, rotate right, and most of the time he's going to miss. You might have to roll once or twice.
Yeah, I found him a little bit more challenging than you did, but that's probably because I didn't have a crushing weapon. I just, he rushed me.
Yeah, he's not an easy fight for this point in the game. But I found him to be a fair fight.
Sure. And also, if you want the icing on the cake of what we were talking about later, after you do kill him, what does his soul tell you? The old Dragon Slayer is reminiscent of a certain knight that appears in old legends.
Yeah, well, I mean, that kind of puts it out there, doesn't it? We're not going to tell you one way or another. That's basically what the game's saying. We're going to let you decide for yourself. And that's what we're trying to do here. To me, I'm going to put my money down and say it is, if not Ornstein himself, some version of Ornstein. It's not just a completely foreign thing wearing his armor.
All right, do you want to put a bet on it?
How will we ever find out?
I don't know. It sounds like a safe bet to me.
Sure. Okay. Your house.
Fuck. All right. My house. What have you got on the table?
Beer.
Yeah, well, you're such a Nazi about me not drinking beer earlier, so maybe that's worth it. let's just leave it alone for now, but I reckon I don't know, probably not right. So after you finally beat him, though, you get to go out onto a little balcony and meet Blue Sentinel Tagre, who can invite you into the Sentinels of Blue.
Yeah, so we touched on it earlier. This area is heavily influenced by the Sentinels of the Blue.
We know that the Covenant of Blue originated in Hade and that they keep the same headquarters that they once kept. And I think it kind of speaks to the power of them that obviously if this land sunk into the sea or the sea rose up and claimed it, the highest points are kind of the most important ones. So if you think about the way the land used to look like, the Cathedral of Blue was right at the very top of the entire city.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it, I suppose. Yeah, that's a very good point. Tagre, I made the quip earlier that he reminds me a bit of yourself. And the reason he does is because he seems to be this guy that isn't dislikable, but very staunch in his views. And I think that screams of you and your position on most things. You form your opinions and you stick by them. And this seems to be what this guy's like.
Hey, that ain't true. I change my opinions if I need to. Oh,
absolutely, but
like, I used to think you were smart, and then we recorded this episode, you said all that stuff.
Yes, well, I'm not, so spoiler alert.
Anyway, this is no place for someone like you. Be gone. You are not needed.
Yeah, this is what Targray says if you don't have a token of fidelity and you try and talk to him. He has no interest in talking to you. He's a bit standoffish about it as well. He's only interested in people that are obviously worthy.
Transient being, you have obtained proof you are worthy of joining our order. You may call yourself one of us and are free to plant your roots in this garden of the gods. Be proud.
I, Targray, do proclaim from this day you are a Knight of the Blue.
Rejoice and bask in your new honor.
Which brings up a couple of points. Firstly, the old knights, they drop cracked blue eye orbs, which are essential to this covenant. And I think it suggests that they're affiliated with the covenant in some way, to the point where I hypothesize that they may actually not just be interested in killing you for the sake of killing you, but be sort of tests along the way to test your mettle, to make sure that you're worthy of joining the covenant. I mean, the covenant, or Targray, is in the heart of the level. You can't get to him straight from the top. You have to fight through a number of these old knights to get to him, and they kind of feel like they're making sure that you have worth before you speak to Targray.
And speaking of worth, I think it kind of explains Targray's position. If you look at the way that he treats you, if you don't have a token of fidelity, it seems quite rude. He never says anything mean, but he doesn't want you around. And it's kind of like, think about Targray's perspective on the whole world. The curse is affecting everyone, and people are finding it incredibly difficult. He calls them pilgrims along the road, disciples of the blue. It's a rough and harsh world to live in, and he has the utmost disdain for people that invade other worlds. And so possessing a token of fidelity shows that you're quite the opposite, that you want to help other people, that you want to stick together and be collective, and that you are a morally upstanding individual. So it's not just some kind of pragmatic question for Targray, it's a moral question. If you don't have the token of fidelity, it's because you are not morally worthy of his presence.
Precisely, and I think that's why he reminds me of yourself. But we should touch on that the token of fidelity you can only get through having spawned into somebody else's world as a summon and helping them defeat a boss. So that's how you get token of fidelities. So that's why he finds them important, because it shows that you have assisted other people. And the token of fidelity is quite an honorable thing, because you can also use it to heal the host of worlds that you may get summoned into to assist.
Yeah, but I never do that. They can heal them fucking selves.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why you're a scumbag. So you can use these token of fidelities to aid the hosts of these worlds that you might come in and help, or you can also use them at these statues, which you see in a moment as you go down some stairs just behind this balcony to the next bonfire in the area. So this bonfire, there's three statues near it, and you can basically spend a token of fidelity to enter an arena and have a one-on-one PvP battle with another enemy.
Have you done that?
I have once.
Did you win?
I didn't. I'm still suffering from terrible lag.
Yeah, my lag has been a bit average since we last spoke. But the point is, I have probably done that 10 or 11 times. I have never won once.
I don't know. I'm still wondering about the lag.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's lag necessarily. Like, sometimes I've just encountered enemies whose spells are just much better than mine. And it makes me concerned, actually, because I think they must match it. It must be banded as far as your level goes, right? Like, if you're level 90, you're not going to be facing people that are level 20.
Actually, this time around, the way they've done it is it's based on your soul memory. So your soul memory is the total amount of souls you've used or had at any point throughout the game.
See, isn't that interesting? Because what concerns me about it is that everyone that seems to be at my soul memory level then is beating the shit out of me. Maybe I've misallocated my skill points.
I wouldn't be too
worried.
Maybe
I don't have the right armor. Maybe I haven't been upgrading properly. Maybe I don't understand how to do proper upgrades on my weapons. I don't know, but everyone's beating my ass. Because Australians can't say arse. It just sounds so gross, arse. You have to say ass.
So, in any case, the purpose of the Covenant is to get summoned into people's worlds that are a part of the Way of the Blue. So, when somebody in the Way of the Blue gets invaded, the Blue Sentinels get summoned into their world to assist them. And if you succeed, you'll get a token of fidelity, or if you go into somebody's world and defeat the boss, you get a token of fidelity. Now, you spend these tokens of fidelities at the arenas, and if you win, you get to level up throughout the Covenant, which is super cool. And there's three or four different levels to the Covenant, and the thing that I found really cool is the higher level you are in the Covenant, when you get into somebody's world as a blue phantom, the more resplendent your blue will be. Nice little touch.
Yeah, I think that's cool.
Now, on the balcony as well, you also have two chests right behind Targray. One of them has five cracked blue eye orbs, which handy. You've probably picked up a few from the old knights at this point anyway. And also a Hyde Knight iron mask, which is actually where we learn a lot of the lore about Hayd. It's the place where we learned that the kingdom got devoured by the sea. It's super duper old. We're not sure if it's a whole realm or if it's just a kingdom. It also tells us that the Way of the Blue has its origins in Hayd, and that's it. You also get a tower shield next to that chest, and the tower shields, just to quickly touch on them, are a little different from most of the round shields and the kite shields in so much as they require a little more strength, but they provide usually more defense, they're more stable, yeah. But you can't parry with them, you can only bash.
And I think stability is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. So stability is going to affect how much stamina you lose whenever you get hit by an enemy. If you have low stability but a really protective shield, well, you might only be able to take one hit before you lose all your stamina. Whereas if you have a high stability shield, you might be able to take three or four hits and you can still hold that shield up and be bold in the face of getting flurried with attacks.
Also from Targray, you can learn the dual bow gesture, which I think is kind of cool. I quite like it.
Yeah, we learn a lot about honor dueling from Dark Souls 1. The whole notion of bowing before a battle and not healing and all that kind of stuff. You either do or don't do it. But being that the Way of the Blue is a fairly honorable covenant, and it also hosts those three statues where you can enter the arena, having the dual bow was kind of a nice thing to enter into the battle with, because you can tell the other person that you're going to be honorable during the fight.
Exactly. So, under the Tower of Flame. So back to the Hades Tower bonfire, across the bridge from the Tower of Flame and down a spiral staircase. So down there you can find a monastery charm if you go around the back of the staircase.
Yeah, the monastery charms are used to cure poison and restore HP.
I've never used mine.
Yeah, I've never used one either. I've found with this game there's definitely more items that have utility purposes like that.
Yeah, healing and restoring spells and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I found there's a few that get rid of poison. There's a few that heal, you know, the Divine Blessing, this one. You know, yeah, I don't know. I never know when to use them. They're sort of fragmented. Yeah, and
when I get poisoned, I generally just use an Estus anyway.
Yeah, so as I said, they're sort of becoming a bit fragmented with these items. I never really, I know I have them, but unless they're in one of my quick slots, I'm never going to use them. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, they're interesting nonetheless.
Sure. So you end up in this kind of dungeony type area, yeah?
Yeah, and it kind of feels like a dungeon. It's probably not, but it's got that sort of dank, dark feeling. There's low light, crappy little fire sconces on the walls and all that. And there's
a couple of old knights hanging around?
Yeah, still a couple of old knights. But in this area, you sort of go down the stairs and off to the right, and you pick up a...
You know, I was leaving this one for you because I've only ever seen this word written down and I don't know how it's pronounced.
Ah, you pick up a dark troche.
Troche?
That's how I'm going to go with it.
Troche?
Troche.
Troche.
Well, either way, I had no freaking clue what they were, so I did have to get on the old Google tubes and look up what they meant.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that word either.
Turns out it's a word that means a small tablet or a lozenge. It comes from the 1600s. It's really old style of lozenge.
They had lozenges in the 1600s?
Apparently. I was surprised as well. And if you have a look at the item image for this item, it does look like a little pill box with a couple of little round black pills, for lack of a better word, in it. And the item description says a troche, which with an inexplicably pungent odor, which... Already I was thinking, Christ, I don't know that there's a single item in this entire world that I would want to put in my mouth, let alone something that has a particularly pungent odor. But this one, basically all it does is temporarily boosts your dark defense. So probably could have been useful for the old Dragon Slayer fight.
The thing is that I mostly just hang on to those items.
Same deal as grenades in most games. You end up with 10 of them and you never use them.
Hmm.
Now, the next part of the item description actually talks about Saint Elizabeth, which I'm assuming has to be a nod to Elizabeth from the DLC in Dark Souls 1. Elizabeth being the big mushroom that sells you a lot of different items.
Sure. In fact, there's another item called an Elizabeth Mushroom.
Precisely. So, to be specific, it says, verbal histories often mention Saint Elizabeth. Her uniquely concocted medicines and potions are still widely used today. So that pretty much describes Elizabeth from Prepare to Die areas of the last game. She was a merchant that sold utility type items, just like this kind of stuff.
Sold utility type items.
She still sells them when I boot up Dark Souls 1.
No, but you said sold.
Oh, never mind.
You know, seldom have I had to correct you so often.
That's just not true. I am terrible with forming words on the fly.
Anyway, so down another level, past a couple of more nights, you end up with this big-ass wooden elevator that takes you right down under the ground.
Yeah, so we're already going pretty deep underground. The outside was on the sea level.
So what's going on with the water?
And we're going even deeper and deeper, and we know that there's a whole city, at least, that's sunk under this water. Christ, we are going deep, and we're still not getting to any of that, so it must have really got sucked under by this sea.
Yeah, unless, of course, the city itself was on the surface and is all just waterlogged junk, and this is some kind of other deep, cavernous thing.
Yeah, possibly. So, we're underground, we're in this dungeon area, there's nothing really of interest. Once we go down this elevator, it kind of leads to the next bonfire for the next area, which I found was interesting. It was called the Unseen Path to Hyde Bonfire, and I got the impression as we left this dungeon area, you have to go through this cave area with these stalagmites coming out of the ground before you get to the bonfire. And I kind of got the feeling that the whole thing felt as though it might be like a escape for the dignitaries of Hades Tower. Yeah. We always hear that these castles, when the kings and the royalties were under threat by people, they would have like these hidden passageways to get out underground unseen. And that's kind of what it felt like. And I think the name Unseen Path to Hades confers with that thought.
Mm. Now, you wrote something weird in the notes. First time I went through the cave, it was a disco. What does that mean?
I'll upload the video, but it's exactly what it sounds like. I walked into that cave, and as soon as I saw it, like, I was in the dungeon area, all my textures were great, everything was fine, my lighting was normal, and here's this little hole in the wall, which I know is the next area that I have to walk through, and it was a strobe light. It was flickering black and white over and over again, and I thought, what the f*** is going on here? I had to assume it was a part of the game at the time, but it didn't take too long for me to realize it was clearly a glitch, because once I got to the other end of the tunnel and started seeing these stalagmites coming out of the ground, they were all like this weird pasty texture that,
yeah, you kind of get that feeling like everything's broken.
Yeah, I'll probably upload a video, but I'll definitely upload a screenshot of what the stalagmites looked like, because, yeah, it just looked terrible without color or anything like that. And it was really disorientating as well, because everything kept flickering black and white, on and off, like basically somebody was switching the lights. And I'm sort of trying to navigate through this area, and I could just see some light in the distance. And I got to the bonfire, and everything looked fucked, except the bonfire had the right textures, and Lucatiel, who's the next NPC that we're going to meet, was standing there, leant up against a wall, looking perfectly normal, like nothing was going on. And I'm thinking, I feel like I'm on acid at a disco.
Yeah, and I like that Lucatiel.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier in the episode that we're going to meet one of my favourite characters from the game.
Yeah.
And that's who I was referring to. Lucatiel of Mira.
What is it? I don't know you, and you don't know me. Things are better that way. You are an odd one. Normally, people keep a safe distance when they see this mask. But you... I'm called Lucatiel. From the land of Mira to the far east, across the mountains. They say Drang Lake brims with powerful souls. And so I came to claim my share. But what a strange place.
What do you like about her?
Well, when you first talk to her, she actually kind of pushes you away. She sort of tells you not to talk to her and that most people aren't interested. And then you sort of push on with a bit more dialogue, and she eventually sort of says, well, I'm wearing this mask, which she is. She's wearing a mask that is kind of reminiscent of Marvelous Chester from the last game. And Marvelous Chester was clearly a nod to V for Vendetta. And V for Vendetta was clearly a nod to Guy Fawkes, so there's kind of a bit of a chain of command going on there. But
chain of command?
Well, a string of connections.
Yeah, Lucatiel reports to Marvelous Chester, Marvelous Chester reports to V, and V reports to Guy Fawkes. So if there's a plot within Dark Souls 2 to overthrow the British monarchy and install a Catholic dictatorship, We're going straight to Luca Teal.
Yep. She's the one to go to. And don't forget, on the 5th of November.
Yep.
Okay. Cool.
The gunpowder plot.
So, Luca Teal. She says that most people are put off by a mask, but you keep talking to her and she sort of laughs and goes, oh, you know, most people are terrified of me and you keep talking, so I guess I'll open up. And she very quickly does. I don't know. I guess I like that she didn't have anything to hide. She kind of becomes an open book fairly quickly, and she tells you a lot about her personal life, which most of the other characters don't really go into.
Yeah, she tells you that her brother, she believes, came through these parts. He was afflicted by the curse, and she suspects that he came here also searching for a cure.
Mm, so her brother sounds like he's on the same sort of path as you, and she's obviously worried for him. Now, we said earlier that she's from Mira, and the armor and clothes that she's wearing, if you check their item description, actually says that only those who have distinguished themselves on the battlefield were admitted into the elite ranks of Mira's official order of knights.
Mm, and she says things like that, that she was poor and from a lowborn family, but she's such a badass
fighter.
Yeah, that she got made a knight.
And she helps you a lot with bosses throughout the game as well. She'll often be a summon, and any opportunity that you get to summon her, take it, because if you summon her for enough of her bosses, then she actually expands her dialogue and gives you more insight into her story. And it's the best way and easiest way to progress her story and find out more about her. And I find her to be a really interesting character at the moment.
Yeah.
So finish her dialogue. And again, she disappears next time you sit at the bonfire. But it's definitely, as I said, not the last we'll see of her. She'll pop up for different bosses throughout.
So now if you continue along that path, you end up in the next area, No Man's Wharf, which we will talk about next time.
Yeah, I think we're running a bit short on time now, so there's no need to go into that. But we will be covering No Man's Wharf next week.
But for now, you can go back to Majula to enjoy the fruits of your labor.
So last episode, we freed, if you remember, Leningrast from the outside of his home. He's now been able to have a chance to set up. And he's a working blacksmith, but he also has expanded his dialogue a bit.
Oh, I'd given you up for dead. Almost had me worried, really. Drat. You're worse than my reckless daughter. Don't spend your whole life in transit, you hear? Even you must have someone waiting back home.
If you talk to him, he's still gruff, but kind of opens up a bit about his daughter, and I don't know how I feel about him. It's as though you remind him of his daughter a bit, and he says things along the lines of, you know, my daughter, she's just out gallivanting around, and he's never sure if she's safe, and she just goes and explores and does her own thing. And
now there's a time for travel.
Yeah, exactly. And he says, you know, surely even you have somebody important back home.
Well, I do, but her face melted, so I bailed out of there real quick.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he meant by that. Like, does he mean back home in Majula or back home in the real world?
Oh, he must mean back home elsewhere, because no one comes from Majula, they come to Majula.
Right. So it's like he's saying, don't go gallivanting around because you have somebody important back home, but the reason you're gallivanting around is to find a cure for this curse so that you can return to some of that normalcy. So there was kind of a bit of a clash there for me. I didn't get it. But yeah, look, as I said, I've warmed to Leningrast, but he's kind of like the harsh father that you respect but don't get all his affection and love from.
Yeah.
And Lysia's now at the room with the contraption that opens up the area to Huntsman's Copse.
If you engage her in dialogue, she explains that the room's a little different to how it looks and that there's two exits. And you can kind of tell already because there's actually an item you can see out through the window and there's a kind of barred door that goes nowhere.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's really surprised by her dialogue when she's like, well, actually, this room has two exits, but maybe I'm just hating on Lysia again.
I love that. The room's not as it seems. Oh, so you mean there's not two exits? No, there is two exits. Oh, I see. So it is how it seems.
Dumbass. But I was kind of let down because when I first walked into that room, you come across the contraption and you can engage it and it says you can't do anything with this at the moment or whatever. And it looks important. It's got a little pattern in that. And they kind of just made it that she sits next to it, does some miracle and it all kicks into place and
works. I wonder, can you just cast a miracle on it yourself?
I was wondering that as well.
I don't have any miracles, so I don't know.
I can test out because I'm playing a cleric. I was wondering that as well, but I don't know that that would be the case.
Yeah, me either. Apparently, those with high faith can pick up items from her as well.
Yeah, so if you chat to her with over 30 faith, you'll get the Idol's Charm and the Saint's Armor from her. So
see, she's generous. She's not a bad person.
She gives after it to she you. Charged you 2k souls to rotate the room.
Yeah, but she's got a stranglehold on the market. Wouldn't you do that?
Bitch.
It's a monopoly.
What's this week's question, Church?
The question is, what's your theory about this old dragon slayer fellow? Is it Ornstein? Is it just another guy in his armor? And why?
Yep, so that's it for this episode, I believe. There's nothing else really to say about Hades Tower of Flame.
Yeah, join us next time to discuss No Man's Wharf. This episode has been brought to you by Zeus, god of Thor. Moron.
We'll see you then.
Why do you always say? It's because you can't think of anything else to say.
I know.
See you then. It just doesn't make any sense. Why do you always say that? Just leave it alone. Just say bye.
Bye.
The Dark Souls 2 has been a Screaming and Digital production. For show notes, please visit thedarksouls2.com or join the community at facebook.com/thedarksouls2. You can also contact us via info@thedarksouls2.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or spread the word. Our theme tune is The Knights of Darkness by Zero Project.
If we fuck it up, let's do it again. Yep. Hi guys, we're the Ducks. No, I'm kidding. You didn't even laugh. You just pulled a face like you were being stabbed. Yeah, it was stabbing laughter right in the chest. All right.
Hey guys, we are the Dark Souls 2.
No, that's not the normal intro.
What is the normal intro? I forget.
I don't know. You've listened to it.
You bitch.
Oh, that's right.